This is me telling you this. The program is Media Network.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archive.
Radio Netherlands. For those of you listening on a really old receiver, Radio Netherlands.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Marks, and to celebrate the penultimate Media Network radio show of all time, we've launched an expedition to the archives at Broadcasting House, as suggested by Richard Goldstein of Madison, Wisconsin in the USA, and Peter Hansen of Copenhagen in Denmark. In the next half hour are two illustrations of what has made our weekly communications magazine famous, namely, the archives.
Jonathan, I think you found something.
To start with, part of a transatlantic special broadcast in August 1992.
This is a very different type of remote here on Media Network at the moment, because it's so remote, in fact, we're not in the Netherlands. We're on the other side of the Atlantic. At the moment, we have a beautiful view of that ocean from a marvellous harbour town in Massachusetts. With me is Lou Josephs, because this isn't just any old harbour town.
This is Scituate, Massachusetts, the United States of America, former home of WYFR, WNYW, WRUL, and W1XAL.
DC World Radio University, Station WRUL, Boston.
These are the international broadcast stations WRUL and WRUW, Worldwide Broadcasting, Boston, United States of America. We are operating on frequencies of 15.29 megacycles in the 19-meter band and 11.73 megacycles in the 25-meter.
That's what the station sounded like on April the 4th, 1947, the earliest disc recording we could find. But whereas various owners put the studios in different parts of the U.S., the transmitters have always been in Scituate.
The transmitters, yes. The transmitters have always been in Scituate. The original studio location, back when it was the World Radio University of Learning, was in the Boston area on Commonwealth Avenue in Boston. Originally, this was an experimental station back in the late 1920s, early 30s. It came on the air from here as W1XAL. The entrepreneur that was responsible for it then launched WRUL as a World Radio University of Learning, and that was interrupted during World War II when the government took over all the U.S. shortwave stations.
Now, it wasn't a religious operation. When you say learning, it was indeed actually teaching, was it?
Yeah, it was like public radio was when it first began. A lot of educational programs of how to plant crops, more of a teaching mission than a preaching mission.
Because WRUL has a democratic principle, this give and take is important. Perhaps you have information which would be of interest to other listeners. Address your letters to the World Radio University, WRUL, Boston, Massachusetts, United States of America. Our next feature will be a special Good Friday program in the Netherlands language.
Just as the Scituate transmitter site in the northeastern part of the U.S. had been important for Voice of America programs beamed to occupied Europe, so after the war, a multilingual service was carried on by Walter Lemon. The little recorded material which survives shows that the programs try to provide some positive entertainment and education at a time when most countries in Europe were still trying to pick up the pieces. The Dutch service proudly claimed WRUL was the only independent shortwave station in the world.
Goedenavond. Gedachtet naar World Radio University, WRUL in Boston, United States of America, over golflengte van 19,6 en 25,5 meter. De enige onafhankelijke korte golfomroep in de wereld.
Okay, WIUL didn't last. I mean, I guess there wasn't any money in it.
Well, there never has been any money in international shortwave radio in the United States because it can't be marketed correctly to agencies. There's no way to accurately show its ratings, how many people it reaches, who those people are, and what kind of products they would buy. And in the 50s, WRUL was sold to the Metro Media Corporation, which moved the facility to New York City and attempted to do some commercial programming from New York. They did a jazz show. They did a DXing show. DXing Worldwide began at the Metro Media Station. They did other kind of music programming, hit parade programming. And then the Bonneville International Corporation was the next owner in the 60s when they bought the station, merged it with their existing station in New York City, WRFM, at 105.1, and simulcast the programming of WRFM and WNYW. So you could hear the station in the New York area on FM and also on shortwave.
This is Radio New York Worldwide. During the next 15 minutes, music in the PM will be heard on 17.730, 11.970, and 15.440 megacycles. WRUL is owned and operated by the International Educational Broadcasting Corporation with transmitters in Scituate, Massachusetts, the United States of America. We now leave the air on 17.845 megacycles to return on 11.880 megacycles within the next 15 minutes by authority of the Federal Communications Commission.
When did it change its call sign from WRUL to Radio New York Worldwide?
Sometime in the 60s, about probably a year after the Bonneville Broadcasting Group bought it.
I never fall in love.
And there she is, that's Dionne Warwick, and I'll Never Fall in Love Again. Ken Lamb along with you here at WNYW, and let me do this. This is WNYW with studios in New York City and transmitters in Scituate, Massachusetts, the United States of America. It's nice to have Mitch Levy sit with us here. Here's a letter from a guy who writes to us from, Leiden? Is that how you'd pronounce it in Holland? Robert F. Brell is his name. And he says, since we changed the call letters to WNYW, this guy must be an old listener. He must go back for years and years.
WRUL, sure.
Yeah, he used to listen to the station when it was known as WRUL. I'm glad we changed the call letters. I like WNYW better. Yeah, he says, anyway, that he listens all the time. He sends a nice reception report, very detailed. And if you happen to be near Radio Sweden, I understand the rumor is that Radio Sweden is going to be going off the air shortly. Do you know that?
Are you propagating rumors on this radio station?
I am, yeah.
Don't you even have
we
facts
have. I
to
got
back
a couple
up?
Of letters from people saying that Radio Sweden
so
is saying
I.
that
I
we've
understand.
Been going off the air.
Ah,
you see?
I got a letter like that myself.
Did you really?
We'll give it to them back double. Two people right. talking about it here.
Now, I hear Radio Sweden has lint in the transmitter. That's what they tell me. So they have to go off the air. June Carter and Johnny Cash.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway?
In 1968, I was listening extensively to shortwave radio on my Hammerland HQ-140X, a tube relic of the past, and I had heard this station and knew it was in New York City, and I lived in New Jersey about 20 minutes away from Midtown Manhattan, and I knew the station was at 485 Madison Avenue, and one weekend I was going in to see a play in New York, and I had contacted Les Marshak, and he said, hey, if you're ever in town, give me a call, drop by the station and tour. So I did. Around about April of 1968, I get a phone call from Les Marshak. How'd you like a job here at WNYW? And I said, well, why not?
The sound of music and news. WNYW.
It's a worldwide fraternity of thousands. Why not find out more about it today? Write for your free sample copy of the Club Bulletin. Write Listener's Club, WNYW, New York, 10022. The Radio New York Worldwide Listener's Club invites you to discover a new dimension in shortwave listening.
At that time, the audio cassette was just starting to appear. It was so new, people didn't really know how to pronounce it or whether it would last.
Another problem of the cassette is cost. Stereo cassettes are generally more expensive than discs with comparable recorded material and playing time. The variety of music presently offered is quite limited. At present, only certain cassette models include a means of locating a particular selection. This is a disadvantage which makes the cassette even less convenient for use than an open-reel tape machine.
Don't guess when your favorite radio station is on the air. There's an easier and more convenient way to find out the schedules of thousands of long, medium, and shortwave radio stations in more than 200 countries throughout the world. It's the new 1969 edition of the World Radio and Television Handbook. You can purchase the World Radio TV Handbook now for just $5.95 surface mail in Europe and North America, or $7.95 airmail anywhere in the world. Send your order now to Handbook, WNYW, New York 10022, USA.
I wish those prices had stayed the same. In fact, though, money was a problem.
The station was never making any money. It had very few advertisers. Merrill Lynch, the World Radio TV Handbook, and in fact, the World Radio TV Handbook is what we call in the industry a trade. The World Radio TV Handbook advertised on WNYW, and they gave them the time free in return for the advertising. If you see a 1969 handbook, for example, you see some rather spectacular full-page ads, and that's how those ads were paid for.
But it was, in fact, live from New York, as it said.
Oh, yeah, it was live from New York up until the 70s, around 1971. The station moved some of the New York studio facilities up to Scituate, where the programming was canned. It was taped music from New York segments and beautiful music. Because at that point, Bonneville was one of the largest providers of beautiful music syndication in the United States. They had this wonderful facility to tape all this stuff on. And so they basically were able to duplicate beautiful music segments, send them up here, and then they had a playlist, a handwritten playlist, pre-computer music playlists, and they were able to just swap the tapes, and this segment would air here, then it would 2 weeks later you'd hear the same segment. The newscasts were live from the CBS radio network. They ran a line to Boston to the local CBS affiliate. The stock market report was live, fed from New York up on a phone line.
Now, looking behind us, you can still see some of the old masts. I mean, the site is, in fact, derelict now, pointing out towards the sea. I guess Europe was the main target. What about the Caribbean?
The Caribbean as well. At the heyday, roughly, let's say, in 1969, 1970, WNYW had five transmitters plus a spare. Three of those transmitters were 50 kilowatts, two were 100 kilowatts. One of the 100-kilowatt units was beamed to Europe, one to the Caribbean. The 50-kilowatt transmitter, one was beamed to Europe, the other was beamed to the Caribbean, and the third, and that was beamed to Africa.
This is All American Radio, WNYW, New York.
This is CBS News. Soviet Communist leader Brezhnev charges China is breaking away from the communist movement. It's the eve of President Nixon's conference with South Vietnam's President Tu, the president scheduled to leave for Honolulu in half an hour.
All that's gone. The airwaves above Scituate, population 18,002, according to the guidebook, sound very different today, flicking across the car radio dial.
Cut traffic so that you don't have to. Every weekend through Labor Day, tune to WATD for the Cape's best traffic info.
Be sure to catch Bill Wilhelm's Sports Exchange tomorrow night, 5 to 6:30. Bill's special guest, BC grad Mike Ruth of the Barcelona Dragons football team. It's all happening tomorrow night on WATD from 5 till 6:30.
WATD is the local station.
Yeah, it's in Marshfield. Call letters, and this is one of those call letters that actually stands for something. It stands for At the Dump.
Part of a media network special on WNYW from 1992. Our second selection was first broadcast on August the 20th, 1988, which looked back on 20 years since the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. An agricultural conference was being held in Prague at the time, and Dutch radio reporters were able to capture unique recordings while marooned in their hotels. Czech writer Jana Baranova helped us with the background.
Thank you.
On the night between August 20th and 21st, 1968, the invasion of Czechoslovakia began. Several hundred thousand troops were deployed from five Warsaw Pact countries.
The action was very well timed because, you know, it is always the surprise which counts. And the surprise was very big because it happened in the middle of the night. Of course, some of our big bosses, Dubček and some more people, have already had some discussions with the Russians. They knew it wasn't so easy to continue, but the Russians never said no. So it was a big surprise. When, at the airport, middle in the, of the night, the Russian airplane landed, but took over the airport. Took over, of course, I mean, not straight away. But the person who was there was just commanded to do that and to do that. And after this first airplane, another came, and about every 1 or 2 minutes, another came. And from the, or out of the airplanes, rolled out the tanks. And they went straight to Prague. So the people were sleeping in Prague, so nobody knew anything, and you heard the roaring of the tanks. The surprise is, of course, terrible.
It wasn't just the Russians though that came, and there were troops from other countries.
Yes, but they came actually later. I think the first troops at the airplane, that were Russians.
The first Soviet military plane, which had landed at the airport, simply guided all the rest in. But they forgot about the man in the telex room, who started sending out reports on what he could see to people he knew in Western Europe. The domestic service of Radio Prague announced at 10 to 2 in the morning that it had an important message to convey, and those listening were to wake their fellow citizens. 8 minutes later, the announcer reported that 3 hours before, troops had crossed the Czechoslovak border.
And what was a very big thing that made us terribly cross in Czechoslovakia was that also the East Germans came. Because, you know, we have been, of course, occupied by the Germans. And then the Germans come again in 68 with their army. I mean, that was a terrible thing.
Within hours of the invasion, several clandestine transmitters were on the air, including a local one in Budovice, which told the East Germans they were needed back at home, not in Czechoslovakia.
Здесь радио České Budějovice. Здесь радиостанция, государственная радиостанция Чехословацкой Социалистической Республики в городе České Budějovice.
Es spricht der tschechoslowakische Staatsrundfunk in České Budějovice. Achtung! Aufruf an die Soldaten der deutschen Volksarmee. Soldaten, im Namen der Interessen der internationalen Arbeiterbewegung.
That was a very bad thing. I mean, if Russians prepared it very good, the action, but if they would have had a little bit more psychological know-how, they wouldn't have allowed this.
But there are some reports looking through the archives indicate the some of the troops didn't even know where they were.
I think most of them didn't know. Of course, the commanders did. But the soldiers didn't know. They were just told that they were going to a country which had a very strong contra-revolutionary group. They didn't know which country it was. They didn't know in which town they were. Because our people, they didn't make any resistance with weapons, but they just went to all the soldiers and spoke to them. And the soldiers asked them, where are we?
Radio Prague came on the air at 4 o'clock in the morning on the 21st with full details of the invasion. They reported that the Russians had set up a clandestine station a few hundred metres from the Prague radio station, calling itself Radio Vltava, after the river which flows through the historic city. Broadcasting on 1428 kHz medium wave, the pro-Soviet station spoke poor Czech and broken Slovak. Although the reports at the time said it came from inside the country, Radio Vltava was probably broadcast from a transmitter in East Germany. On February the 12th, 1969, when the need for the clandestine station was over, Radio Berlin International appeared on the same frequency. Vltava later became the name of one of the Czech radio networks. But back to Wednesday, the 21st of August, 1968.
Že i ten náš socialismus československý přece jen vybojujeme, že nám vydrží.
At 7:35, Radio Prague reported that six Soviet tanks were surrounding the station building, and that if the studios were taken over, the last thing they would do would be to play a tape of the national anthem. The tape went out a minute later, and the station left the airwaves. You can hear that the tape was hurriedly put on. But not all was lost. Western news agencies reported that Czech youths had taken down all the street signs in the capital to confuse the enemy.
Yes, not only the students, I mean the whole town and everywhere, the people. And nobody, the funny thing is that nobody sent a message to the others to do that. It was just an idea, and then the people heard, oh, there, they have taken the boards down, so we do also. So in the towns, but also in the country, yeah, the things were turned around, the directions were wrong. They were just written, Moscow this way, Moscow this way, Ivan go home, go away. So the people couldn't go through the country. I mean, they could go, but they didn't know where they were going, where they were headed to. Sometimes they just went in a circle.
What about communications during this period? I mean, were the telephones cut?
Controlled. Not cut, but controlled. I mean, you couldn't call abroad or anything like that.
Some reports were reaching abroad, though. Radio Moscow's English service said Russian noble assistance, as it called it, had been requested.
The founder has pointed out that the fraternal socialist countries consider it their highest internationalist duty to support the peoples of Czechoslovakia in defending the gains of socialism.
But these reports were counteracted by Radio Prague's foreign service, which returned to the airwaves on Thursday, the 22nd of August. In the early 60s, long before any invasion plans were dreamed of, the Soviets had supervised the construction of a clandestine broadcasting network throughout Czechoslovakia. They thought troops from West Germany might invade, and so a network of mobile standby transmitters was set up and given to the Czechoslovak army to maintain. Once the Soviets turned out to be the aggressor, the mobile transmitters were handed over to the Czechoslovak resistance. Radio Prague's external service lost no time in setting up mobile transmissions on 6055 kHz, which were well heard across Europe despite the reduced power.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia, broadcasting continuously in English, French, German and Italian, as well as Czech, and bringing you late news bulletins and reports as we receive them of the situation here in occupied Czechoslovakia. We are transmitting in the 49-meter band on 6.055 megacycles. However, since this frequency is being jammed, please tune us in by turning slightly to the right or left of this position on your radio dial.
It didn't take long for the Soviets to start jamming Radio Prague. That's what some of the jammers sounded like inside the country. But to be effective abroad, jammers in the Soviet Union, carrying the Moscow Mayak music program, were used to blot out some of the low-power clandestine stations. On other transmissions, the jamming wasn't at all effective, leaving listeners in the rest of Europe with a fascinating live account of what was happening. Like this English newscast on the second evening after the invasion.
The East Slovak town of Košice tonight gives the impression of a frontline city. In the main square, young people using Molotov cocktails set two Soviet vehicles on fire. Soviet units opened fire and there were several casualties. According to unverified reports, there have been about 10 dead and more wounded, including Soviet soldiers. I beg you to excuse any possible slips of the tongue, but I am translating straight from a slip of a Czech text.
The Soviet news agency TASS said the broadcasts of Radio Prague were coming from agitators in West Germany. Direction finding in the West didn't support that argument. Meanwhile, jamming equipment was being transported into the country. The next recording is rather weak, so we've transcribed the Radio Prague transmission. Czechoslovak railway men last night stopped a train carrying spotting and jamming equipment designed to interfere with the free and legal Czechoslovak radio to which you are tuned now. The train was stopped about 100 miles east of Prague. Today, the presidium of the party decided to take over the municipal radio and run it under the name of the Central Committee Free Radio. From Plzeň, West Bohemia, it is reported that the free and legal Czechoslovak studio there continues to work unmolested so far. On Monday, August 27th, the Czechoslovak leaders returned from Moscow, where they'd been forced to sign a secret protocol reversing the reforms of the Prague Spring. Radio Prague began to change its style. The clampdown came as a shock to many people. A year after the invasion, Radio Prague looked back on the event with a very different view to August 1968. The event was not an invasion, it said. It was engineered by Western anti-socialist forces.
Crowds of Gorkhas began to form, and in order to cope with the confusion, riot units had to use batons, tear gas, and water from fire hoses. On the other hand, the result is a failure for the forces that are openly hostile to socialism.
The clampdown on press freedom didn't happen immediately after the invasion, though.
Of course, Dubček was too free, so then Husák would do the job. And then actually about 8 months later, it was about, let us say, March, April 69, from that time it started to be very, very bad again.
Part of the Media Network documentary Truth Shall Prevail from August of 1988. Well, next week, as you may have heard, it's the final radio show. We've had just under 1,000 reactions. Thank you very much for all those. And from these suggestions, we'll make a historic montage of our best bits, as it were, from coups to comedy. So make a date to join us for that. In the meantime, on behalf of the entire team here in Hilversum and around the world, this is Jonathan Marks wishing you a very pleasant weekend.
Right, that's your 30 minutes worth. Now it's your turn to react by phone, fax, postcard, or mail. Because this is your show, okay? Comprende? Good.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.